Okay, I'm really excited today to have a very special guest on the line, Ms. Mary Lou Tyler from Predictable Prospecting. And it's been such a pleasure getting to know Mary Lou over the years. Mary Lou is one of my mentors, one of the people that I've worked with in the past, and I'm really, really grateful that that you've taken the time to be here with us today. So Mary Lou, perhaps we can just start off by talking a little bit more about your background and how we got to know one another.
Sure. I've essentially been doing this work, which is top of funnel sales process, sales enablement, sales strategy, whatever you want to call it. It keeps changing as life goes on. But I specialize in starting conversations with people we don't know and trying to get them engaged enough to get them through to a qualified opportunity. So back in 2008, I met a gentleman by the name of Aaron Ross. I was working with a client who was looking to put in a lead gen system, and I have worked in contact centers for a long time. So I was a specialist in outbound prospecting, but not necessarily leveraging the internet and social channels. So that got me searching online, found Aaron, and that culminated in creating a book called Predictable Revenue in 2011. Shortly thereafter, we had the opportunity to meet you, Gabriel, and we actually flew up to Canada and had a series of meetings with you and worked on some partnership opportunities. And so you and I have ebbed and flowed since probably 2011 now, right?
That's right. Yeah. I remember when you came up here and we went and sat down at Vidge's restaurant in Vancouver, which was still one of my favorite restaurants, probably. Yeah, incredible meal. And yeah, it was really great to have you and Aaron up here. And with Predictable Revenue, and similar to your new book here, Predictable Prospecting, I've basically been highlighting about half of the book because there's so much good content in there. And, you know, you've been in this business now for how many years?
It's going on 30 when you count the contact center stuff. So it's been a while before the internet, before cell phones. Yeah.
And that's what I love. That's what I love about talking, you know, speaking to you about this topic, because you really bake in the actual fundamentals of prospecting. It's not just the latest gimmick or hack. It's, you know, when I'm talking to you, I mean, you're directly connected with people like Jay Abraham and other, you know, incredible marketers. And so, you know, I feel like when I speak to you, I'm getting the source, like the true knowledge of what works and what doesn't, because you've been there and you've done that. And that's just such a privilege, you know, to be able to learn from people like you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's all grounded in, you know, our mantra is always be testing. So I'm willing to try all the new stuff and apply it to the framework. That's the beauty of having a sales process, is that, you know, it's like molding your lead gen with these different applications and pieces of software and technologies and methods. But you have the superhighway in place, so all you need to do now is take a piece of what's new, plop it in there, give it a test, give it a whirl, and run it against your sampling theories. And if it works, great, you keep it. If not, then you tried it. So,
exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Always be testing and measuring and let the data tell the truth, right?
Yes, it's the stress-free way of, you know, conducting a lead generation outreach program where you're trying to close business with high performing, high likelihood of closing, high lifetime value clients.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do is dive into basically three or four different topic areas today. So we're going to go into sales process, actually sales development reps or SDRs, cold emailing, and then some pieces around technology as well. Okay. So let's start at the top with sales process. What has been your process, Mary Lou, for identifying new prospects and driving sales?
Well, the book goes in great depth on that, because I've found as I've been working with clients, especially since the release of 2011 of Predictable Revenue, it talked about the ICP, the ideal customer profile, as a foundation for making sure that you're talking to the right people at the right time. But it wasn't deep enough. So I spent a lot of time, the last 5 years, in fact, fine-tuning that ICP, and chapters 1 through 3 of the new book talk about how to generate what we call a SWOT 6, which is your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities and threats, and overlay that with some of the marketing methodologies and data-rich research that allow you to not only understand who you should be marketing to and selling to, but why you matter and why people should change from what they're doing now in order to do business with you. So we start with that, and then that dives right into the ideal account profile. We changed it to ideal account profile because a lot of people now are seeing the value of account-based selling. So we wanted to make sure that this book focused on that for those people who are looking at their top 20 per SDR accounts, you know, that are like, I have a lot of clients who just have 250 accounts they're going after, and that's it. So we have to make sure that they really hone in on that. So the ideal account profile goes very much in depth in the book. The next chapter is where predictable revenue just fell flat, in my opinion. And I, you know, was part of the book, so which is the ideal prospect personas. Mm. And I think with, armed with the SWOT, the ideal account profile, and prospect personas. Now, these are not the marketing personas that, you know, if you're in a bigger company, you may have seen a marketing persona. Think about the end result of a marketing persona is to get a marketing qualified lead. The end result for us, a prospect persona, is to get that first meeting, is to have that are we a fit call, is to disqualify them. So we're going further into the pipeline, which means we really need to think through what those personas look like and mm-hmm. how we attack them, so to speak, from a sales point of view, from a sales conversation point of view. So when I have all those, and there's a few other concepts in the book that talk about leveraging the products that you're selling by persona. We call them buying scenarios. And then from there, calculating your list, then you have what you need in order to be able to really assemble, at least from a list perspective, the right sales process for going after those accounts.
Perfect. Okay, that's wonderful. And, you know, I know a big topic for us has always been this concept of specialization. And mm-hmm. in fact, I learned the concept of specialization from you and from Aaron and Ross. And now it's one of the, mm-hmm. the key tenets to my practice and what I teach my clients and work with. But okay. I mean, why, in your words, I mean, why would you say sales team specialization is so important?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at the anatomy of a salesperson, there are different skills that one needs depending on where a prospect is in the relative position of the pipeline. When we are at the top of funnel, which is where I focus my efforts, we're talking to a lot more people. And our goal is to really disqualify them into a small subset of accounts and people that we can continue our conversation with. That requires a very different skill set than someone who is now taking an opportunity and taking it all the way to close one. So because the skill sets are so different and because the amount of records that we're working with is so different, that we need different skills in the sales roles. The role at top of funnel is really one of more conscientiousness and really going after people on a daily basis in a very habitual way. Whereas as we move further into the pipeline, then we are really looking at these accounts as unique. And you'll hear people say, salespeople especially say, you know, every sale is different. Well, that's probably true from opportunity to close. But when you're going from first meeting to opportunity, there's a lot more to weed through. And there's a lot more systematic approaches that we know work, and we can leverage those systematic approaches in order to guarantee a certain number of opportunities that we're going to generate each month. Now, if you go even further up, which is the marketing qualified folks, the inbound leads, those are people from a level of awareness who have already become interested or are evaluating your product because they filled out a form, they did something to engage with marketing, and they're coming inbound. when we're doing outreach, we have five levels of interest or awareness to worry about, not just the two of interested and evaluating. We have people who are unaware. We have people who recognize there's a problem but don't really know solutions out there. And we have people who recognize a problem, know a solution, but don't necessarily know that you are one of those solutions. So if you think about it, you know, the skills that you need to bubble people up to the top of the funnel, so that you can have these conversations is very different than when you're already engaged. Very different. So that's why we like to separate the roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In addition, let me just say one more thing. You know, mm-hmm. the SDR role now is even splitting. And, you know, that's not in the book either, but basically with account-based selling versus, you know, a fully mass automated selling approach, we have two different types of SDR roles now that are emerging.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, when you're thinking about working your top 20 and you look in your working status, and now I'm talking relative position in the pipeline, the accounts are usually already in working because you've identified them as your top 20. There's probably been a lot more research done of who the targets are, and your methodology for reaching them is more hyper-personalized. It's what everybody's talking about, saying, oh, we need to write emails that are hyper-personalized now, that the SDR takes a template and customizes it for each person that they're sending to. Well, that's a beautiful concept, but it only works with a limited number of accounts, which usually would be your core or anchor accounts. The other, 80% of the accounts that are good candidates for you, but that you haven't designated as anchor or core, those are treated with as much automation as possible, but intelligent automation, which is a different SDR role, because then you're going through, and it's probably what you're doing now, you're doing a lot more of data personalized emails. They're mm-hmm. smarter than mass, but they're not quite hyper, right mm-hmm. in the middle. But they're reaching a good number of clients that are great candidates for you, but they may not be your core anchor accounts. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference. So the person doing the ABS, account-based selling, is going to be also a more phone proficient rep. They're going to be calling in blocks, immersing into the account, doing what I call an intraday phone, essentially calling. Whereas the SDRs that are working the more mass personalized emails, driven data driven, are probably responding to responses, or maybe they're chasing click-throughs. But they're not going in and saying, okay, I'm going to blitz into my 20 top accounts today, and I'm going to phone in and around this bullseye, which we discussed in chapter 3, of direct and indirect influencers until I get a meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Very different.
And going back to this topic of specialization, do you find that SDRs act as a good farm team to become future account executives down the road? And the core challenge here, of course, is that I see with a lot of companies is they want to, spend $80,000 to $100,000 to hire an account executive. But it takes 6 months just to train and onboard that person before they become that true industry expert. And so mm-hmm. maybe you could just speak a little bit to how SDRs, in your opinion, whether they can or cannot be a good sort of farm team or a future account executives.
You know, my co-author wrote about this, I think, in the latter chapter, I think chapter 9, which he has a very valid point. He even suggests that when you're interviewing for the SDR role, that you mention right up front that this is a position that has room for advancement. So, I think that it's desirable to be able to get someone who will come in and do the SDR role, knowing it's more habit-based. And then once they have become proficient at it, it's based on merit, not on tenure, then they have the opportunity to advance, quote-unquote, to an account executive role, or maybe they become an account-based SDR, because that's a little bit, in my opinion, that position is probably going to be between the SDR basic role and the AE. And then they have all this progression upward. And then there's the whole account management side of things, which is after they're a client, They also can move over to account management where they're going to grow the business, the existing business, with upsell and cross-sell. So it's not that I don't think these folks can do all these roles. I think you just, when you separate the roles, you're really focusing them like Kentucky Fried Chicken here in the States, you know, one thing and doing it really well. That's really what you're looking for, is just one role that they're going to do really well and master. That's not to say that they can't do the other roles, because if you onboard them and test them on the hiring side for the sales aptitudes, they should be able to perform all roles, and they'll settle in on a role that really works for them and that they're happy doing.
What would you say the average timeline is before you would recommend promoting somebody from an SDR function to an account executive role?
I think it's about 18 months is what I'm seeing, somewhere in that range. So a year and change. I think, you know, like anything, the more that the roles are separated, the faster they're going to be tracked and ready to go for an AE. If they get bogged down in other corporate stuff where they're not doing the SDR role daily, then it's going to take longer.
Mm-hmm. And last question here around specialization. I mean, I've personally measured this, but I'm curious what your take is. After somebody moves from, say, like a hybrid approach where you have one salesperson that's doing everything, prospecting, account executive work, and account management, and then they actually adopt a proper specialized model,
right?
What kind of efficiency gains are you seeing in terms of, you know, greater sales activities and then higher win rates and so forth? Like, do you have some numbers that you can share with us?
Well, it's more guessing, because I don't take on clients that don't specialize. That's one of my kind of non-negotiables. So I can only use my solos, you know, the people who are one-man shops or one-woman shops, and then once they hire their first person. So, you know, it can be as much as fourfold that I've seen, in that if you think about the four roles being 25% of your time for each, and then all of a sudden you are now 100% of the time, then it's 3X, 6X, some are 10X of what they were doing before. But basically what I shoot for is still the 8 to 10 opportunities a month, that predictable revenue used, because I'm making the assumption that SDRs go further into the pipeline. So, you know, if we're a full-timer doing all roles, I'm hoping for 1 to 2 ops a month. But if we go to specialization, then I'm looking for 8 to 10 or above.
Got it. Yeah. And those numbers definitely align with what I've seen. I've measured before and after scenarios, and I've seen on average it's 300 to 1,000% increased sales efficiency increases. And not only that, but actual sales operating costs tend to reduce by about half. So it's really exciting. Right. There's definitely a business case for it.
And you're more advanced in that than I am, because of my non-negotiable of working with clients. Because I will, I don't want to fight that. I don't want to fight that particular or negotiate that particular piece, because that is the only way I can guarantee the results that I guarantee.
Is
if they specialize. I do take some solos here and there, some solo entrepreneurs. But going in, you know, we have an agreement that they're not going to get the results that my other clients get.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. 100%. Okay, so moving on here to, I mean, you alluded to this a little bit around the ideal account profile and ideal prospect profile. And I'm not going to use the acronyms for it, because it sounds, well, like it just sounds kind of funny to say IPP, but I love it. I love the idea behind it, because, I mean, when I first read that in your book, it was kind of like this aha moment for me. I'm like, oh, such a good idea. Of course. You know, because I for a while there, I was thinking something was missing from that particular equation. So can you just talk a little bit more about how that particular idea came to you, the purpose behind it, and just go a little bit deeper on the topic?
Well, we were with predictable revenue. It was a 5-step process, and we would get people assembled, and then we would start activating, and people would get stuck and gunky in the sell the dream portion of the framework, which is when you start having conversations with people and talking about your value proposition, why they should change, why now, and why you. So it was really out of desperation and trying to figure out a way to get my clients fast-tracked faster, that I started thinking about when I was in development of all things and developing operating system code, we used to have personas for product market, for product sale or programming. And they were specific to user experience and how people navigated the software. And I thought to myself, what in the world? Why don't we have one of these for sales? So I started to compile, essentially, I started to do interviews. I started to ask my clients to give me everything they had with anyone who touched the prospect inside. I talked to industry experts, and I came up with essentially a 15-step development methodology for prospect personas. And we've dwindled that down to something more reasonable in the book. But it really... what really did it for me was that the personas that are for marketing really generate marketing qualified leads. They get someone to slightly raise a hand. And what we're trying to do is to get someone to want to engage in conversation with us, which is a lot beefier and a lot more work than what we had before. So this was a way for me to consolidate all of the ideas of working with a prospect, what their challenges are, whether they're strategic, financial, or personal challenges, that mattered, you know, and we never thought about that for predictable revenue, but it became very apparent that setting that up allows us then to craft our emails, to send voicemails, to create scripts if we're doing scripts for our conversational pieces, to handle objections. All of that was under discovery when we started putting together the prospect personas, and we just didn't have it before.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love it because it just it goes into depth, and you're also profiling the company as well with, you know, the firmographics and so forth, which is great for list building. Yep. And not a lot of people will go beyond just, you know, okay, well, this is the industry that we're going after. This is the general employee count. And, you know, here's the key title.
You know, and I'll tell you a good story about this too, which is pretty funny because it was with Jeremy, Mike, the co-author. He was a client of mine, and he's the one who we wrote the book together. And we did a prospect persona definition on Betty. I can't remember what Betty was, but she was some type of liaison between IT and marketing. And they were going to use their house list. When you were talking about list, it jogged my memory. And so, great, let's use the house list. So we did the prospect personas, and then we did a count in the house list of how many Bettys there were. We got a number. And then we went over to LinkedIn, and we counted the number of Bettys there. They had 500 Bettys in their house list. There were 50,000 potential Bettys that we could contact in LinkedIn. If we hadn't done that prospect persona definition, our campaigns would have fallen flat on their face if we just used the house list as is.
Interesting. Let's just dive a little deeper on that topic. So in terms of building out a list, so let's say you bring in a new client and you've developed your IAP and ideal prospect persona, and now it's time to go out and build a list. What can you just share some best practices for the ways that you go about doing that?
Well, I will preface it by saying to your listeners that I work mostly in enterprise accounts. So there is going to be an established list, typically. This is not speaking for startups who are just, you know, starting out with their list. So what we like to do first is go to the house list. Those are opted-in names. They're names that, over the course of time, have been generated through trade shows, workshops, executive briefings, whatever it is, whatever lead gen channels that they've used for marketing purposes, we have this list. If, as in my client, who's co-author, if we find that the list is lacking, the next thing we go to are purchase lists. We also look to see, based on the persona, whether or not there's enough counts in those purchase lists, like a ZoomInfo, Hoover's, those larger companies, and see if there's enough counts in there to make our campaigns meaningful and statistically viable. If that doesn't work, then we're going to look towards industry lists. We're going to look at creating our own lists through crowdsourcing. We're going to maybe hire someone offshore to help us generate email addresses and phone numbers. So we start with what's available in the marketplace, and we dwindle that or just keep going until we exhausted those, and it might be that we have to build our own lists where we're paying more per lead, but the quality will be there. So I've had clients do all the above, you know, basically start with what they've got, and some end up going offshore and then work out a deal where they're getting a number of leads per week that they pour into their campaigns so that they have a statistically viable cadence and sequence that they can market against.
And in terms of statistically viable, what would you say the minimum number is that is required for a statistic analysis?
I still use the old Z and T distributions, which seems to work really well. So if you're looking, you have to look at it as a margin of error, and it's going to be a swing plus or minus. So the number 400 emails, 400 contacts, gives you plus or minus 10% margin of error, which is a 20%, you know, 20 swing either way. But that is the best number to use. The next one down from that is 96. So 96 gives you, you know, I think it was a 80 to 85% confidence rate, but there's a bigger swing now. There's a bigger gap between, did we do this right or did we not do this right? But those are the two numbers I use with clients. So we try to get per SDR, especially if we're splitting the campaigns by persona, we want to have 400 persona of the same persona in a cadence so that we can test the viability of our emails and also the cadence itself. When to use the phone, when to leave a voicemail, when to do this ABS type of intraday calling in and around the bullseye of influencers.
Mm-hmm. Got it. All right, perfect. Well, that was really a valuable conversation around sales process. And what I'd like to do now is dive into a little bit more tactical discussion around the actual SDRs. And so with the sales development reps, I mean, we've alluded to this a little bit, but in the world of cold emailing, I mean, cold emailing is a very popular topic area nowadays. How important is the phone? Is the phone still relevant?
Well, you're talking to someone who grew up in contact centers. So by definition, I'm going to say the phone is very relevant. And I do, though, like to handshake the phone with email and social. So you're kind of warming up the chill, if you will, with those other levers of contact. And then the phone is used as a follow-up mechanism to those social and email channels and ways of starting conversation or warming up that chill. But I do use the phone. I think the phone, once you get in that rhythm of contacting people at the best time to call, which is an algorithm that we actually perfected in the call center using predictive dialing in the 90s, it gave us the opportunity to call our prospect personas at the time that they were going to be in the office. And once we did that, we reduced the number of dials, which we got better connects. And we also didn't blow out our list. So the list fatigue numbers went way down because we used the phone more. Now, with our current sequences, what I recommend with clients, and I have three different sequences that I use with clients. Some of them are afraid of the phone to start. So we do an email only. Well, I call it the while you're sleeping campaign, because basically you only follow up on responses and that's it. And we try to get to the predictable revenue numbers of 7 to 9% response rate. So for every 100 emails, we want 7 to 9 people to reply either positively, negatively, or neutral. And we're looking for 3% positive, 2 to 3% neutral, and the rest negative. And if we reach that on an email-only campaign where there's no phone follow-up other than responses, we think we've done a good job. I have some examples that I shared on a webinar recently with a client who created 8 emails in this While You're Sleeping campaign, and he was able to achieve with his 2 prospect personas, one of them was 23% response rate overall in aggregate, so emails 1 through 8, and the other was 37% response. Now, think about list fatigue. For every 100 records, we heard from 37 people who were in sales and 23, you know, people who were in IT in this case. which means our list is going to be a lot happier because we're not blowing it out and we're not over socializing it and mass emailing it. Every one of those emails, except for 1, 2, and 8, were value driven. Emails 1, 2, and 8 use the old style predictable revenue emails. I still bumper those, not with everybody, but again, our mindset is always be testing. So I go in with a known entity, which is the predictable revenue emails 1, 2, and 8, and which are basically 1 and 2 are trying to find the internal referral and confirm that I've got the right guy. 2 is an in-thread reply to 1 with adding a little bit of value prop to it. And then 8 is what we call the Hail Mary and saying, hey, you know, I essentially don't want to be a pest. I've sent you some, what I think is our most valuable content in 3 through 7. And I completely understand if this is not a good time, just let me know. So we bumper those. 3 through 7 are fully packed with why change, why now, why us, with testimonials, endorsements. And it's really content assets that are viable to that level of awareness we talked about before, trying to figure out where people are in their head in order to be able to engage in conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, there's a few lines that I've gotten from some clients of mine that I'd like to share. So the first is on the Hail Mary, and I actually bake this in around email 4, where I say, you know, I know there's a fine line between being persistent and annoying, and I don't want to cross that line.
Right.
And I find that particular message, I learned that from one of my clients in Silicon Valley, and he learned that from his mentor that he learned 20 years ago. But it's such a good email because it tells people that, you know, you care about them, you're thinking about them, you're persistent, but like, you don't want to cross over that boundary of being annoyed, because there's always that balance, you know? And I think that when I'm running my campaigns, I often get responses from people saying, you know, thank you for your persistence. They thank me for, you know, consistently following up, and they appreciate the professionalism, but there's some people that it just annoys them. So I want to know. So that's one thing. And, you know, and then the other thing that I wanted to sort of ask you about, and I was having a conversation with somebody this morning, another client of mine this morning, about this sort of this concept of internal referrals. And do you think that internal referrals are better placed when they are from a peer or from a superior, as opposed to somebody from the bottom? Like, let's say you're trying to get through to a VP of sales. I mean, do you think it's better to go in through the side or through the top or through the bottom?
I always like to call above and work my way down. I've really not changed my thoughts about that. If I'm doing research, then I go top, middle, bottom, whatever, to try to find information that I think would be relevant to have that first conversation with my target. But if I'm actually requesting referrals, I will always start at the top and work my way downward. Right. Because I think just from a social, I don't know, from a psychological perspective, it does have more of a recognizable sort of, oh, I should respond to this because my boss said it might be a good thing.
Lights a fire under their butt, so to speak.
Or at least gets them to sort of lean in thinking, oh, I guess I should talk to this guy. Yeah.
I need to give them the time of day now. Yeah. Because my boss told me to.
Right.
That's really interesting. And going bottom up, I think can work if you have lots of time and lots of money, but often people want to generate results quickly. And so, I agree.
Top and down. Bottom up does work for research because we use bottom up for our persona research, which allows us to get more information about where to navigate around. And for ABS, it's going to, you know, especially with these giganto companies that have 57 marketers. And if you're selling into marketing, who do you talk to? It's not that clear. I love reading these email or these group posts from people saying, you should do your research, you should know me. And we did a project for a local, you know, a company here, a $1 billion company that was trying to sell to marketers. They came up with 38, I think, marketing definitions in companies. So how are you going to know who to call? You have to go in and you have to ask some questions, strategic questions, in order to be able to get to the right person, because the titles and roles are all different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So diving into SDRs. And so when you're hiring an SDR, I mean, this has got to be one of the hardest things, I think, in the world of specialization, at least for me anyways. Finding good sales development reps is not an easy task. And when interviewing, I've probably interviewed over 1,000 SDRs at this point and personally managed over 100 of them myself. And I still, to this day, I struggle with finding the right SDR hire. And so I'd love to learn a little bit more about your process in terms of hiring an SDR. Do you check references? What's on your checklist, you know, when you're hiring somebody to ensure that you're getting the best possible person in that role?
Well, again, Jeremy is hiring more than I am because I'm working on putting the frameworks in. But I do have a list, and I actually am doing a webinar on it, this very topic. And it's really about, everyone seems to do the informal interview, you know, having an interview of the potential candidate. And that is like one quarter of what you need in order to be able to hire the right person for that role. So in the book, we talk about if you just add a skills test to that, meaning that the day in the life of an SDR, for example, I had a friend of mine here in Iowa who was hiring an SDR and asked me if I would interview her. And I said, yes, I'll interview her, but that's only like 17% of what you need in order to make a good decision on an SDR. And he says, what do you mean? I said, I want her to write an email. I want her to leave a voicemail. I want her to craft a script telling me of a value prop. I don't care what she's selling. I don't care if she's selling how to make tamari balls, you know, how to, whatever, I don't care. But I want her to leave me a voicemail as to why I should get back to her. Mm-hmm. So when you just add those skills in there, or a find the right person call or a mapping call, that's going to bump up the probability that you're making a more confident hire by at least 50%. Just right there. And then there are other tests that, you know, that people don't do that are available, that are the aptitude tests for sales. There's another one that talks about what we talked about before, that conscientiousness. We need to have SDRs who are habit driven, meaning that if they'll do the same things, the same tasks over and over again until they perfect them, which is what we want. We want to be able to have meaningful conversations a day. How many? Ideally, five. Five meaningful conversations will guarantee us 8 to 10 opportunities a month. So if we're doing that and we're expecting that of an SDR, we need to hear them. So I put her through, in this case, she wrote an email, a cold email. She wrote a follow-on email. I had her do a role play with me where I was throwing objections at her. And it didn't really matter what the objection was. She was, what product she was selling. It's just how she handled those objections. And the fact that there are four or five, we all know we're going to get. Not interested. I already have something that works. What's this about? You know, so there's standard rejection or objections that we should be testing for when we're in the hiring process. And a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've done role plays always as step two in my hiring process. So I have a checklist, and then there's the role play. But I've never actually had people write cold emails or leave voicemail messages or do some of these other important functions. So I'm definitely going to do that.
These are the livelihood. I mean, this is what they're doing. So if you just chunk down their daily role, you've got to test them on each of those components. Now, granted, they're not going to be knowing your product or service, but whatever they're passionate about, like baseball or like me with tamari balls, which are balls that you make with thread, you know, just have them talk to you about that.
Hmm. Okay. And what about references? Do you check references, and how do you do that?
Well, a lot of times the SDRs are fresh outs. They're out of college. So just the fact that they graduate and they got a good degree, you know, good grades, we check that. But in terms of previous work, I will call references and check on those items relating to the role of the SDR. You know, if they were in a previous position where they had to show up on time every day. I want to make sure that they had good attendance. If they had some type of task that they did every day, I want to ask how they did with that task, because repetitiveness is part of the SDR role. Habit is part of the SDR role. So I look for those traits in, if I'm talking to a reference or if I have enough references to contact, I'm looking for the traits of the daily role of an SDR within mm-hmm. that person.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And if you could share the webinar information or at least a link for people to register, I'll include that in the show notes page. And there's also a checklist of questions that I've used to check references as well that I got from, I modified it from Top Grading for the actual SDR function. And so I'll link to that as well. And I'll share that with you, Mary Lou.
Okay, that's great. Yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of managing an SDR team, what are the most important KPIs that you look at in terms of a dashboard? I know you talked about the 5 meaningful interactions a day. What mm-hmm. are the other criticals or KPIs that you like to look at?
Well, if we're looking from an email campaign, we're going to use all the predictable revenue numbers, which would be the number of responses we get, deliverability. We're looking at our list fatigue, things like that. But for the SDR role itself, we're looking at the number of meaningful conversations per day. We're looking at movement interstage. So if we're going from a cold or new queue to a working queue to a qualifying queue, we're looking to see how many of those records move on a daily, weekly, monthly and quarterly basis. And we're looking for consistency. We don't want to see peaks and valleys. We want to see a consistent stream of records moving. So we look at that. We look at the ability to add and grow the database, especially for account-based selling. If we don't have a lot of the contacts that are in designated in our bullseye, then we want to look to see that they're making an effort to grow the database as well. So those are the kinds of things, the actionable metrics that get us from stage to stage to stage. So interstage metrics, and then intrastage metrics would be the conversations that they're having, the number of emails, if they're sending out their own emails for the hyper-personalization, is it the right number for the number of accounts that they're working?
Got it. Okay. Oh, that's helpful. And then in terms of cold emailing, just going back to that topic, do you have any kind of do's and don'ts of crafting messaging? I mean, I know that there's some people that sort of hear about this concept of cold emailing and some of these personalized automation tools, and they just go to town. I mean, I was just chatting with a couple of the outbound vendors that I use, and it's a big problem right now where people are just spamming lists, thinking with the same templates, and they're not putting any thought into it, and it's not resonating with the marketplace. And I mean, what are your thoughts on that in terms of some of the do's and don'ts?
Well, I still follow the predictable revenue model, which is 50 emails a day per SDR, 250 emails a week. So you can't really spam per se, unless you have a large team. And then I look to the compel with content framework that's in the book, which is the ability to craft an email that triggers some emotion, gets you to a place where you immediately hit them between the eyes with the challenge that is ahead of them and how life could be the outcome that they could be getting given this challenge, the gap between that. And then from there, specificity around the opportunity that lies ahead with them if they engage in conversation with you. So that whole framework can be done with an 80-word email all the way up to a 480-word email. And I have examples in the book of that.
Wow, I'm taking notes here. This is good stuff. And so in terms of short versus long messages, I know in predictable revenue, it's short and sweet BlackBerry size messages. Do you find that those still tend to work better, or do you find the longer messages can work as well?
We mix and match, and I think testing against your product, your persona, that's going to drive. If it's an IT guy, sometimes their brevity is better. If it's a marketing person, they like to read a little bit more. It really depends on the persona. Craft the emails as if you're sitting across the table from your persona having a conversation with them. Do they like it short or long? Do they like you to get right to the point, or do they like more information before they make a decision?
Oh, that's perfect. Okay, got it. Okay, well, before we wrap up here, just a couple more questions about technology, and then just some final words of advice. So what would you say are the must-have tools for you, technology tools for 2016 and beyond?
Well, you need some type of marketing automation system, because we're leveraging technology, so we're sending emails out. And so you need something that can help you with that process so that you don't have to be spinning all these plates, as a friend of mine says, trying to remember, did I send him email number two and do I need to call him now? Or you want that to be done for you. So whatever whatever technology you can use to help you with your sequence, the cadence within that sequence, which is, you know, the phone, the email, the social, when should I do what? You need that tool. There's some tools for pre-getting the list, research tools that are lovely to have because they cut down on your ability to get that list going, you know, better, faster. But again, you can do the old manual approach and get there. So I'm not as critical about having that, but for sure, I want some type of automation tool to leverage the technology for sending emails, sending voicemails. Then you need something to collect your responses in, because we're using those sales conversations, and the sales conversations we have, we're recording the data from those sales conversations so that we can recognize, again, by persona, what pain point resonated with them, when in the email sequence did that pain point resonate, and was the pain point we started conversation with the same pain point that got through opportunity and close? Why do we want to know this? Because we're trying to reduce lag in the pipeline. The more intelligence we know about which pains resonate faster are what we're going to put into our email streams. So we really need to have this 180 circle back around to our email engine that's constantly being fed by the conversations the reps are having. So this concept of call wrap-up is extremely important. That's a call center term. Whenever an agent hung up the phone, they had to wrap up the call, give it a disposition and some kind of code to tell the systems, where should I file this thing? And I do that with my folks. It's, you know, rudimentary. It's not as automated as it was in contact center. But we record the pain point discussed.
Mary Lou, can you back up for a sec? I just cut out. The last thing I heard was call wrap up. So can you just start over at call wrap up and restate what you were saying?
Yeah. So what I do is I make sure that my reps do something called call wrap up, which is a call center term that we used because we were using predictive dialing systems. We had to be able to disposition a call and then let the dialer know where we wanted that call routed for the next time it was placed. So I do the same thing with the SDRs. We track a few key items, and I have codes for those, and I can send them to you, Gabriel. But we basically are looking at whether this pain point that resonated was still the same pain point throughout all of our conversations, or if it changed during the course of the pipeline. Mm-hmm. Then we want to know essentially any language that they've mentioned that we hadn't heard before. We want to be able to record that, because we're going to use all of that in our marketing email engine and also voicemail. We're trying to reduce the lag. So we want people to be able to, you know, hear a word or listen to a pain and immediately have it resonate, as opposed to waiting to email number seven when it could have been email number two, mm-hmm. where the pain resonated faster. Mm-hmm. Just like you were saying, you want to know faster before you were saying you want to know faster whether they want to continue or not. Well, we want to leverage the wrap up so that we know the order in which we should present pain in our sequence.
That's really smart. I like that. And so just in terms of tools, like, do you have any specific tools that you would recommend for cold emailing or marketing automation and so forth that you like to use?
Like I said, I work higher up with enterprise accounts. So we are, believe it or not, more limited than a SaaS company, because the approval process for an IT to approve software takes a lot longer. So we're kind of, you guys are probably more nimble than I could ever be. But for the term outreach, I like outreach.io. There's Tout, there's Yesware. There's SalesLoft. There's all these great tools that help you with that sequencing. I think it's more function, and we talk about this in the book about tools. There's more function that we want you to think about and then align that function with the actual tool itself, rather than do it the other way around. Mm-hmm. I think if you map through your process, find out how you want to go after these accounts, are you doing key accounts? Are you doing core accounts? Are you doing anchor accounts? You know, what is this definition of accounts? And that would lend itself to which tool is going to be the best tool to use rather than the other way around. Then for marketing automation, you know, we use all the top end ones, Eloqua, Marketo, those guys.
I totally agree with what you're saying. And I find that, you know, market and technology, often people that I speak to feel held hostage to the technology that they're using because it's so complicated. And then they start driving their sales process around the sort of the templated sales processes or tools that are in these various systems, like Salesforce, for example. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of companies where I've come in and I've seen a sales pipeline and it hasn't changed. It's the exact same sales pipeline that Salesforce is programmed in. And that's one of the most intimate things that a company can do in terms of adjusting their sales processes to that actual, those pipeline stages. And so, I think that 100% I agree. The fundamentals are so important, and the tools all serve a purpose, but it's important not to get distracted about on those fundamentals.
Exactly. And, you know, being a software engineer, I mean, we used to go up against this all the time. You know, which programming tool do you like? Well, it's really based on what is the application I'm designing, and once I get through the design of the application, which tool is going to best fit? That's how I want you guys to think about the pipeline. Let me design the pipeline, the processes, how I'm going to leverage technology, people, and process. And once you figure that out, and it's really drawing it, is like the way I like to do it, then you can then plop on the tools themselves as to who's going to do what, which does what, and look at it that way. I think that's a better way to do it rather than stacking up all the stuff and then realizing you're not using, you know, 75% of it.
Exactly. Yeah, just getting into overwhelm. Okay, last question is just advice. What would you say is the best piece of advice that you've received on the area of sales and or marketing?
I think it's really a mindset. It's whenever you get on the phone, whenever you craft an email, whenever you're thinking about having a conversation, remind yourself that you are a peer or a colleague of the person who's on the other end of that line, the other end of that email. You are as equally important as the person that you're trying to convince to try your product or service. If you do that, your tonality over the phone is going to increase to a point where they are thinking that they're talking to someone who is just like them. And I think if you can really think about changing your mindset, that you are a CEO of a company, that you are a director of marketing or a director of sales ops when you're getting on the phone, then you're going to be a lot more successful.
That is such good advice. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mary Lou, for your time. There's so many good insights that you shared with us. We're going to be linking to your book and to some of the different resources that we mentioned in the show notes. And thank you for spending the time with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gabriel. It was a lot of fun.